Welcome back to The Signature of Man, a podcast dedicated to pursuing truth in the philosophy of art and beauty. This is episode 6 of The Signature of Man podcast, and I'm your host, Miguel Benitez Jr. In this episode, I had the opportunity to interview Dr. John Mark Miravalli. Dr. Miravalli received his pontifical doctorate from the Regina Apostolorum in Rome and is associate professor of moral and systematic theology at Mount St. Mary's Seminary in Emmitsburg, Maryland. He is the author of several books, including Why God, Why Jesus, Why the Catholic Church, How to Feel Good and How Not to, The Ethics of Using Marijuana, Alcohol, Antidepressants, and Other Mood-Altering Drugs, and Beauty, What It Is, and Why It Matters. His debates with noted atheists on the topics of God's existence, theistic morality, and same-sex marriage are available on YouTube. He and his wife have 6 children. In this episode, Dr. Miravalli and I discuss his book, Beauty, What It Is, and Why It Matters. John Mark, thank you for joining me on the podcast today.
Thanks so much for having me.
So you've written this book, Beauty, What It Is and Why It Matters. What is it that first drew you to the subject of beauty?
You know, it's funny. I do a lot of arguing in my job. I've done some online debates with atheists, and I do a lot of sort of moral issues classes. So I argue all the time. And I was trying to figure out what the next class I was going to work on. And I also bike to work out here in rural Maryland. And I was thinking of doing like the problem of evil. And all of a sudden I thought, you know, I'm tired of arguing. I need a break. I need to pick a different moral topic. And I looked around. It was so gorgeous outside. And I thought, I really don't know anything about what beauty is. I'm going to teach a class on beauty. And it was that simple. Wow. I was looking for something that I could teach that I wouldn't have to argue about, you know, real aggressively.
Yeah.
And I just looked around and thought, I'm just going to do it. And there's been almost nothing in my life where on a sudden spur of the moment, I've said, I'm going to do it. And then I've actually done it. And so it was just a wonderful, the way it played out for me.
Yeah, that's excellent. I know that, and people, you know, this is a common thing, but like teaching something is the best way to learn it. Like it's going to, you know, and as a, you know, professor, I too can attest to that. It gives you some deadlines, you know, you got to have some stuff prepared within a certain period of time. You get to have the discussion with students, which they oftentimes help us in the thinking process. And so I think that's really interesting. So the subtitle of your book is What It Is and Why It Matters. And we're talking about beauty. And I think that's a great place for us to start. One of the things I appreciated about your book is that you didn't back down from offering definitions for beauty and art. So let's start with beauty. How should we think about beauty? What is it? You know, we kind of have these, and in some of my other episodes with some of my other guests, you know, we have these common phrases of beauty is only skin deep, or beauty is in the eye of the beholder. These are unquestioned assumptions in our society today, right? So how should we think about beauty?
So I kind of have 2 ways of approaching it in the book. Both of which I think are you know, there's a lot of precedent for in the tradition. One is to see immaterial reality present in a physical form. And that doesn't necessarily mean in a tactile form, but in something that at least can be imagined.
Right.
So that's one area. It's where we delight in seeing some immaterial truth or goodness, but insofar as it's been concretized. In the sensible or imaginable world of experience. So that's right. One. We can talk more about that in a second.
Sure.
And then the other way that I really hone in on even more probably in the book is that beauty, I would say, is a combination of order and surprise. And those are kind of hard words to get real traction with, to get a grip on. But order, real basically, just means something being what it's supposed to be and doing what it's supposed to do.
Right.
And surprise means the response of the mind to what it does not find obvious. So it's the attention grabbing of something that really you didn't expect or you didn't find just self-evident initially. So the example I've been using lately of a combination of order and surprise is when your kid takes their first step.
Right.
Because obviously that's a normal thing for a human being to do. People walk, right?
Sure.
And yet when it happens, it blows you away when it's your own kid, right? Maybe your wife calls you at work. He took his first step.
Right. Like,
yeah, that's what people do. That's normal.
Yeah.
I know, but it's so beautiful. I want to cry. Right. I never imagined it would feel or look like this. So to me, that's like an easy sort of.
That's a really good example. Yeah.
Regular experience of putting order and surprise together when something is the way it's supposed to be and does what it's supposed to do. And also when it blows you away because you weren't expecting it would be like that.
Yeah. And so you mentioned order and beauty and, or I'm sorry, order and surprise. You kind of maintain that throughout the text. The one that surprised me was surprise. Because order is typically brought to the discussion, that seems to clearly be there. And it's interesting the way you phrased it. Now I'm thinking even about proper function. And now you kind of have the moral element. We oftentimes ask that question, how are those two things related, beauty and goodness? And so, but it was surprise. And as soon as you explained it in the text, it made all the sense in the world, but I hadn't come across that quite that way before. What was it that kind of brought your attention to that? How did you think of surprise as one of these elements of beauty?
That's a great question. So we share a common interest in G.K. Chesterton, and he is actually always talking about surprise. In fact, in one book that I quote in the text, he says that the most beautiful thing on earth is astonishment. And at one point he says, there's another book where the man who was Thursday, where he's talking to an atheist and he says, it's always surprising when things work because there's so many ways for them to fall apart. The fact that it happens to work is always the most astonishing thing. So this connection of order and surprise, but also, I read a lot of contemporary fiction and they're always talking about the need to surprise the author.
Yeah.
Not be predictable. The other thing that I brought out in the text is there's so much emphasis in singing in the Old Testament on newness.
Yes.
So it's sing a new song unto the Lord. It's always the Lord who does new things. And so, and then finally, this is the final point. There was a word and I didn't know what to do with it in the tradition, particularly with Aquinas. And that's the word splendor.
Right.
Light.
Yes.
That's always getting brought up in talk about beauty. And I didn't know how to cash that out in practical terms.
Right.
And for me, it was something that grabs your attention by being unexpected. So anyway, just roughly, that's kind of how I settled on that ingredient.
Yeah. No, and to me, that was one of just the great elements of what you're putting forward because, and sure, in some sense, you're capturing kind of what others have said, simpler way or more straightforward way. But I thought it was a super helpful way of thinking about it and even helps us kind of resolve some of the issues that arise in aesthetics to think about it in that way. Because surprise, it also then explains why sometimes we take beautiful things for granted, right? So if you live in a particular place, every December we go and visit some friends in Tennessee. And when we're driving, we see the beautiful mountains and are just blown away from it. Me and my family live in Florida. So we don't see that on a daily basis, but they see it every day going to work, every day going to the grocery store, every day. So again, it's not that it's not a surprising thing. I would say that, I wouldn't be surprised. You think about the example you gave about the baby that's now taking their first step. I think Chesterton would say every day we should be surprised that we're walking, so that surprise should still be there, but it explains why sometimes we miss beauty. Why sometimes, because there's always that question of, well, why is there so much disagreement? And why is it that one person's blown away by something and another's not? Exposure has something to do with that. And
And for me, that was, I would say, the biggest personal payoff for me for doing this research was while I was researching, while I was getting my ideas together, one day I was exercising and a really hideous, sinful, horrible image came into my mind, just hideous. And I'm like a lot of people. I've seen a lot of things that I shouldn't, both through my own sins and also by accident.
Sure.
But what freaked me out was I indulged that thought. I mean, it was this really twisted, awful image. And I didn't shake it off for a second. I enjoyed it for a second. And I said to the Lord, why would you make me so that I would enjoy something like this? Why would you make it possible for me, your son, to be susceptible to such twisted pleasure? And because I was doing this research, I thought, because I was made for surprise, because you made me for beauty. And because I've been undisciplined in finding surprise in what is ordered, I have opened myself to taking pleasure and surprise in what is disordered. And that just to me was a big help, because it means, okay, I'm not a monster. I was just made for this thing. And I've, like every other faculty, I haven't sort of stewarded it as well as I could have. But that's okay. Like I can get back on the right path in all these areas. I just have to do it through beauty.
Right. Yeah. It ends up being a capacity that we have that is actually a blessing. And you know, we use it, as we often do, for things that aren't good and that aren't beautiful. But we have that capacity so that we can better enjoy the good and the beautiful.
And it takes discipline, as you pointed out. If you let yourself get used to things, you will spoil, you know, all the good.
Right.
Which, again, was Chesterton's great yes. contribution. He even talks about, right, walking around the world so you can be surprised by your family again.
Right.
You know, keep it fresh.
Right. Yeah. Standing on your head. I can't remember the illustration he uses, but I think it's grass. And he talks about, we should be shocked that it's green. Like it should surprise us, you know?
Right.
And so,
that's right.
I think it was just so helpful. And again, it gave language to something. So I think I had a similar question to what you had, but you were able to provide that language of surprise that I thought was really helpful. So staying on this idea of beauty before we kind of shift over to discussing art a little bit, I think you've got a lot of good things to say there as well. You mention this idea that a pursuer and what is being pursued and the relationship between those two things, right? Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that the pursuer of truth will become knowledgeable. The pursuer of goodness will become morally upright. And then you address this idea of, what about the pursuer of beauty? And so I'd like to give you a chance to respond to that. What is it that happens to the pursuer of beauty? What does the pursuer of beauty become?
So I guess it seems to me that both body and soul were made to sort of be likened to what we consume. Right. So, right, when we consume, they say you are what you eat, for instance.
Right, right.
And intellectually and imaginatively, right, we take on the characteristics of what we think about, which is why it's so important to pray every day, right? Because it makes you more godly. So if beauty is order and surprise, my sort of, unabashed hijacking of Chesterton's language. Sure. If order and surprise is beauty, then someone who is engaged in beauty, someone who is pursuing beauty, would exhibit a life that is more orderly and surprising. And so Chesterton has this great line from his book, Man Alive, where he says that we should keep the commandments and break the conventions, or maybe it's the other way. Break the conventions, keep the commands.
Right.
That sounds to me like a perfect formula for a beautiful life, because keeping the commandments means that your life is ordered in the sense that it conforms to the nature of being human.
Right.
And breaking the conventions means that nobody's really going to know what you're going to do next. And you're not going to, your behavior will be really remarkably unpredictable. So for instance, in the lives of the saints, you see someone like St. Francis of Assisi, you see someone like Mother Teresa, but you also see monks, you see Fra Angelico, you see all these people. And boy, they sure don't line up in any way other than keeping the commandments.
Right.
They're just radically different, surprising, unpredictable. And so, I just think that's a great, real simple formula for living beautifully, is to keep the commandments and break the conventions. And again, that's just from Chesterton.
Yeah. So let me ask you this. I'm curious, because I mentioned to you before we started recording that I've written a chapter that'll be contributing to a book that'll come out next year. And I'll talk more about them on my podcast when we get closer to that time. But this is something that I started thinking about as I had already read your book, and I'm kind of interacting with my own writing. Do you think that maybe there's a connection between beauty and holiness? So when we think about pursuing the truth, right, we become, we gain knowledge, goodness and righteousness, beauty and holiness. And I thought it was interesting you even brought up the saints. And it seems like what you're describing is holiness, because it's something that's set apart. And so when you said surprise, and I'm thinking set apart from this idea of holiness, might there be a connection there? What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think very much so. So there was a book, I want to say the guy's name is John Seward. It's called The Beauty of Holiness and the Holiness of Beauty or something like that.
Okay.
And he makes that same connection. And certainly, you know, with our Eastern Orthodox brothers and sisters, it really, right, their focus on holiness is always framed, like the gospel in some ways, in metaphors of light.
Right.
Right. Brilliance.
Yes.
And attractiveness. And is the word mesmerizing light, right? Entrancing light. Peter saying, it's good that we're here. We just want to be here and we just want to look. So I guess this is a great question. I haven't thought probably deeply enough about it, but I guess I would say holiness is fascinating and unlike actually sometimes just raw information or even doing morally the right thing. So one of the things I point out is that you can know the truth and not feel anything. You can do the right thing. You can do the good and not feel anything, but you're not really having an experience of beauty unless you feel something.
Feel something, unless
unless you're overwhelmed, that you wouldn't really call it an aesthetic appreciation. So to me, holiness captures that fullness. It's not only living in accordance with truth. It's not just living in accordance with goodness. It's something that causes a gut reaction in everyone around you. So yes, definitely.
Yeah. And like I said, as you mentioned the saints, you know, I'm thinking, like, we're not just surprised by an act of goodness that they did. We're not just surprised by the knowledge that they acquired. What surprises us is holy living, right? That their life was set apart in a different way than the common individual. And so it seems to me, and again, I'm just proposing this, I'm thinking through it myself, and so definitely don't want to put you on the spot or anything, but it seems like pursuer of truth becomes knowledgeable, pursuer of goodness becomes morally upright, pursuer of beauty is becoming more holy, right? We're in that process of our sanctification, of our whole, you know.
I like that. I like setting, because in a way, again, just working through it with you, beauty is sort of when all the faculties come together. Right. So for instance, in the catechism of the Catholic Church, it says, you know, and the idea of the Thomistic idea of virtue is when your emotions are finally integrated with everything else in pursuit of God. Right. And it says very clearly, we don't just want to serve God with our minds or even with our wills, but also with our feelings. Yeah. And that's the final sort of, integration of the Christian life.
Right.
Which is what we mean when we talk about people who are holy or saintly. And so, yeah, to me, I would see beauty just as it's almost the fulfillment of the transcendentals. I would see holiness as the fulfillment of the human life. And that's when all the faculties come together and go to God.
Good. Yeah.
So I like it. I like that, that lineup. Right.
Okay. So now let's shift our attention a little bit to art. And these two are oftentimes discussed together. But I think, again, one of the things that, and I recommend our listeners check out your book. I just really impressed with it. And I think that you hit on some of the really important aspects, some of the important questions about art. But when we think about art, the very first thing that I'm typically dealing with, I teach undergrad, I teach at a state college, so I have diverse students from all different backgrounds, but I think a really good picture of the culture, right? And so when I'm talking about art in my humanities courses, oftentimes the very first question I'll ask them, I let them know, in this course, we're going to talk about all different kinds of artworks and the way they connect to culture. But what is art? And I'll get answers like, anything is art. Yeah. Anything you say is art is art. It's kind of a personal thing to say what art is. And so I want to read for our listeners a little bit of a quote from your text, and then you can kind of interact with it. Tell us why you hold this position. And all right, so you write, why don't we accept that there might be a legitimate symbolic gestures that convey important and perhaps unpleasant messages to certain groups of people? Let's admit that these gestures don't require a concern for beauty any more than a rescue flare or a police siren. But we won't call that stuff art. We'll call that stuff that's concerned with beauty art and just leave it at that. That should give us enough to go on with our analysis. And so you use that as kind of your working definition there. So why should we see beauty and art connected in that way? Why should we kind of reduce our view of what is truly art to those things that are concerned with the beautiful?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. That's a great area to sort of hone in on. And I'm just going to go from the hip here and we'll see what happens. Yeah. So it seems to me that symbolic works, which are meant to convey urgent and sometimes unpleasant messages, like a police siren, like a rocket flare, maybe even like Guernica by Picasso, right?
Right.
I don't know, but maybe, right? It seems to me those may be valuable, but they're valuable in a sense. What they are trying to convey is something that is a means, not an end. So an alarm, let's say a siren is not something that anyone would desire for its own sake. And even the experience you get, I should say the experience that it's designed to give you, is not anything that a person would be desiring for its own sake, right? It's a warning. It's a message. It's something to give you a shock for some reason because you've got to do something. So it's right. Instrumental. The experience, not just the object, but the experience is instrumental. Whereas art, the experience of appreciating beauty is not instrumental. It's an end in itself. It is a perfection of the human nature. It is something that of itself perfects our faculty and gives us fulfillment. And in a sense, there's no, what's the point of that question that is reasonable when you are experiencing beauty? So I don't know what you call, and again, the word art, I think, is a word that we have to make our own decisions about, right? Sure. There's no sort of magisterial way we get to decide how other people get to use this word.
Right.
But I wanted to use art in the sense of fine art for something that is designed to convey an experience that is an end in itself.
Okay.
While recognizing that there are other types of experiences that can be given in visual or auditory ways that convey important experiences, but experiences that are instrumental. Get out of the way of the fire truck.
Right.
Or the example I give from the scriptures is where one of the prophets cooks his food on his own excrement.
Right.
And presumably that's a war. You better repent quick because bad
right.
stuff. That's good. It's holy. It's right. It's in the scriptures. Right. But it's not trying to give an experience that's an end in itself. How does that sound? What do you think about that?
So I've got some questions in light of that, but I think that's good. And one of the things that came to mind to me is I always try and convey to my students, when I say something's not art, it is not necessarily saying this thing is bad,
right?
Because I think that's what happens. A lot of people think to limit what is art is to be elitist, right? And say, well, this isn't good enough to be art. Where I don't think that's necessarily what you're saying. I know that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is it's a different kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's playing a different role. And so even when we think about, I know that in a lot of kind of postmodern art movements, basically the picture has been completely removed and you just get text, right? And you'll get blocks of text as visual art, not as a poem like that, right? And so when I look at that, and I think we kind of intuitively know this, but I think even just kind of testing it, you know, trying to think about what it is we're talking about when we're talking about art. What is written may be powerful. What is written may be true, but the way it's been presented, it's serving some other purpose. It's not art. And I'm not saying that what's been written is bad just because it's not art. I'm saying it's just a different category of things. And so I kind of hear you saying something similar when you're trying to narrow something down. You're just saying, look, I'm trying to properly order things in what they actually are.
It's just for the sake of categorization.
Right.
And because it's a book on beauty, obviously I'm more interested in focusing on works that are either designed to promote beauty or even, right, I'm interested by negation, I guess, in works that are designed to attack beauty.
Yes.
Which is I think a lot of stuff in the postmodern era is really it's not sort of this is good. It's just serving a different purpose. Some of it, I think, is really bad. It's really
right. Yes.
It's trying to achieve an anti-human goal.
Yeah.
So just getting those categories, I think, is super helpful.
Because I think the and this is what I again try and warn, because I know that many people are hesitant to trying to kind of draw some lines where You have art and non-art. But unless we do that at some point, then we're losing meaning. I mean, the word art doesn't mean anything anymore. Right. If everything is art, nothing is art. And so we lose any kind of meaningful discussion at that point. And so that's why I encourage my students. And I'm not saying it's easy, right? There's things that we're like, yeah, that kind of seems like art to me. But yeah, we should ask ourselves why, on what basis are we kind of categorizing this with these other things? I thought that was something. And what the proposal that you make in tying art to beauty, I think also helps us with the aesthetic question of how are these vastly different things connected?
Yes. Right? Yeah. Very good.
So why is it that we call poetry, music, a painting, dance, a sculpture, a dance? Why is it that we call all these different things art or fine arts, you know, creative writing? Why is it that we kind of lump all these things together and connecting all those different things seems difficult to do? And beauty kind of ties those things together.
Yeah. And one of the most challenging areas that I think, again, for me was really helpful to try to think through is where we the arts that are connected to utility. So architecture and culinary art,
right,
where they're clearly, we would be doing this stuff anyway. Why do we call it art? Why do we talk about culinary art or architectural art, you know?
Right.
And to say, these are actually, they belong to, at least to some extent, in the same field as painting and dance and sculpture.
Yeah, and it's interesting because architecture, it was easier for me to, and that's an ongoing debate still in the field, is architecture art? For me, it was an easier leap to say architecture definitely is. And I think largely because throughout church history, it's been very intentionally used in an artistic way. And so that was easier. Where my mind has kind of opened up is to the culinary arts. And I'm realizing there's a lot more there than I had initially thought about. And just even if we think about aesthetic choices and the way that they affect us, similarly, the aesthetic choices that we're making in the culinary world also affect us and play a similar role. So
yeah, and I would say that's probably one of the greatest areas. If sensitivity to beauty is an aid to human fulfillment, then it seems to me that culinary beauty is one of the most underdeveloped appreciations that a lot of us have. So for instance, I teach seminarians, guys who are going to be future priests,
right?
And when we talk about gluttony, and C.S. Lewis does a great job with this in lots of places, actually, we talk about how actually there's a good chance that they will be sinning more by what they refuse to eat than by overeating. Right? If you go to a parishioner's house and they prepare you something that is precious to them, right? They prepare you, so they put their heart and soul, they put all these aesthetic choices, they put all the self-expression. I've been in these situations,
right.
And it's something that you have a powerful distaste for and almost an immature aversion towards. You are going to sin against charity, you're going to sin against beauty, and you're going to really obscure the face of God, who, you know, depending on your position, you more or less represent to people, by saying, no, I don't like that. And so to me, and the guys hate it, man, they hate it. I mean, they hate that.
right.
While you're in seminary, if you have some sort of immature, I will not eat that thing, you got to get over it.
Right.
You gotta learn to love the good things in the world and that people offer to you as a sign of love. Anyway, that's a real moral, I think, a moral challenge in terms of beauty for a lot of us.
Right. And I think that it's interesting the way that you stated it, because we know that when it comes to both, and I just think we don't make the connection all the time. We know that when it comes to art, a lot of times we have to cultivate our appreciation of what is beautiful. And, you know, that's a lot of what we've been talking about. But we also know that with food, that there's acquired tastes. Yeah. And so it's interesting because that would make sense. If there is some kind of connection between these two things, that we would need to cultivate kind of our tastes, both in the culinary world and in what we would traditionally see as the art world.
It's so interesting, the word education, right? Because education for a lot of us has become just education intellectually. But of course, classically, it was also education, not just with intellect, but then also with will. So not just truth, but also goodness. But it's also, right, you have to have aesthetic education. So for instance, in my case, you know, before teaching this class that then turned into book, you know, I've got a decent music background, okay, literature background, but I'm very weak in the plastic arts. And so I got, you know, one of those great courses and went through the history of Europe. Oh, it's changed my life. It changed that great course. I mean, it made it harder in some cases.
Right, sure.
Now when I teach in an ugly classroom, I know exactly what's wrong with the whole thing.
Right, yeah.
Education in aesthetic appreciation is a key element of education.
Right. Yeah, excellent. Okay, so just one final question here. I was going to ask it anyway, but I think it becomes even more relevant in the way that you talked about art as an end in itself. I want to touch on your criticism of art for art's sake, because I think oftentimes when people are thinking of art as an end in itself, they kind of fall into the idea of art for art's sake. I'm kind of a critic of it. You are too. Our friend Chesterton is very critical of art for art's sake. So what does art for art's sake mean, and why is it so problematic? And how would you, now that you've kind of answered the other question the way that you did, how would you separate those two things of art as an end and then?
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, because earlier, if you remember, I said, not that art or true art or whatever isn't in itself, but the experience towards which it's directed.
Good. Okay.
Isn't in itself. Yes. So definitely artwork is never an end in itself.
Right. Good. Okay.
A human person's fulfillment is an end in itself, and objects which are designed to facilitate that are necessarily nobler than objects which are designed to facilitate some action of an instrumental nature.
Okay.
Good. So thank you for clarifying that, because that could be easily missed. So anytime you make anything under the human person an end in itself, that's a species of idolatry. And one thing that was really wild to me, looking through the Book of Wisdom, and then also even the line of Cain is where you get some of the music stuff in Genesis,
right?
Is how often the fine arts and the representational arts are connected with idolatry.
Right.
Famously in the Old Testament. And there's a philosopher of all kinds of things, but art, named Jacques Maritain.
Yes.
And he has this great line. He says, art for art's sake, if that means that art is an end in itself, then it's nothing short of idolatry.
Right.
Right. And many people say, well, I'll sacrifice everything for my art. I'll sacrifice my life. I'll sacrifice my family. Yeah, that's just idolatry. That's
right.
Putting something below the human being, above the human being, and even ultimately above God.
Right.
So it seems to me the proper role of the object of art is instrumental, is a means to facilitate an experience that's not instrument, that's not a means, namely the perception of beauty. And ultimately, as even Plato said, that experience of beauty, even at the created level, is continuous with the final experience of uncreated beauty.
Right.
So yeah, very, very helpful. I think it can't be the object itself, or the skills required to produce it cannot be an end in itself, but the experience of beauty is, because it's the fulfillment of the human person.
Excellent. Good. I think that's a really helpful kind of clarification, and really important, because what has happened is, with art for art's sake, is this attempt to take art and say, you're not allowed to critique it. In any way, you can't make moral judgments on art. You can't, talk about art. And it's odd, because we're still always making comparisons. We're still always talking about how it makes us feel. So even when we try and relativize art, or try and make art kind of this distinct world, we're oftentimes, I think we can acknowledge feeling certain ways is better for us, feeling other ways is worse for us. There's still always a kind of component to it that is being measured, that is being considered. But I do think that was one of the things, and that's why I'm really glad we were able to get that clarification in many Christian circles, because art for art's sake, what it's taken to mean is, it doesn't have to have like utility. It doesn't have to be useful in some kind of, you know, physical way. Like, something has value in it if it is beautiful, and that's enough. And I want to affirm that, but I want to say that's only one one leg of what art for art's sake means, where art for art's sake also means that art is the end in itself, and also that you can't bring judgment, you can't bring anything from the outside world into discussion about the art. You have to kind of enter the world of the art, use the language of the art, and not use standards that are from outside of that. And that seems problematic because of the way that art overlaps with the good and the true.
Yeah, I think that's perfect. I think I run into this problem. People talk about being utilitarian with art or consequentialist with art, and they're not sure what they mean by it. Because if they mean that not all physical objects can be evaluated based on physical benefits, then they're right.
Yes.
But if they mean that physical objects cannot be evaluated based on their human benefits, then they're wrong. Right? So every object must, to sort of justify itself, every material artifact of any kind is only justified insofar as it serves the body or the soul, or both, as in the case of something like food. But to act like, anyway, this is just to affirm your point, which is that you have to be, I think people need to be careful when they use the term utilitarian. Do they mean physically utilitarian, or do they mean that objects are supposed to benefit human beings? Because if the latter, then we want to be utilitarian in that
sense. Yes. Good. Yeah, that's really helpful. And so I think we can kind of wrap up with this. I just want to get your thoughts on this. So would you say that it's fair to say when we're looking at beauty, the kind of connection between art and beauty, art then does have a responsibility, right? Art is not just any kind of expression we want to make, but it has a responsibility to point us to or to help us kind of cultivate this desire for what is ultimately beautiful, or push us towards that which is universal. So this particular artwork pushing us towards that which is more universal.
Yeah. Morality, right? If we talk about means and ends, right? Morality, the macro scale, just means helping human beings get to God, right? Helping human beings reach their ultimate end, which is union with the Lord. And then you can talk about intermediate ends, which are modes of human fulfillment that are conducive, and we're pursuing them is conducive to our ultimate end, towards union with God. All art has the obligation of helping human beings reach intermediate ends that are conducive to the ultimate end. It seems to me that would be, and that intermediate end characterized in terms of beauty. And of course, it's only ever, so for instance, people always get that Soloviev quote wrong, where they say beauty will save the world. And people always think that means an aesthetic experience provoked by human art. Soloviev is talking about divine beauty, the beauty of Christ that will save the world. Art is only ultimately defensible insofar as it starts us, but doesn't bring us of its own sort of motive force on that trajectory. So yes, definitely. Yeah. The responsibility is enormous because you're either bringing people towards or away from their ultimate end. What could be a greater responsibility than that?
Yeah. Awesome. Well, John Mark, thank you so much for taking the time to have this conversation. I've really enjoyed it. I think listeners will enjoy it. So thank you for that.
Thank you. Just very delightful. I really appreciate your enthusiasm, and I can't wait to see how how the development of your own thought in art continues as well. Yeah.
All right. Thanks a lot.
All right. God bless.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Signature of Man podcast. Please be sure to subscribe to the podcast if you haven't already, leave a review, and share it out on social media. You can also email any comments or questions to thesignatureofman@gmail.com.